Greetings and salutations. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski, and we are all about restoration, ecology, and the Anthropocene. How do we slow down, stop, and turn around the level of habitat degradation and species loss that we are experiencing right now in this, our fair world? What an incredibly, incredibly busy week. I'm sitting here right now suffering from lack of sleep, and I'm here for you. So on with the show, right? So rather than cover just one topic this week, there are a few things that I want to talk about because they're significant. There's a lot going on. First of all, in the state of Oregon, Governor Brown has convened a group of timber industry representatives and representatives from conservation organizations, and she has orchestrated a memorandum of understanding between these two groups for the purpose of reforming certain aspects of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Now, you know, if you've listened to this show at all, I've been advocating for radical changes to the way forests are managed in the state of Oregon. If you ever do a Google, there's a Google GIF out there that depicts the amount of clear cuts that are taking place in the state of Oregon over the last decade, and it is devastating. Don't get me wrong, and I've said this before, I'm not against the utilization of wood for various and sundry purposes. That being said, I am not an advocate for the harvesting of quote-unquote forest resources for the purpose of decimating the ecosystem. It doesn't have to be one or the other. It doesn't have to be a primitive hunter-gatherer culture in order for us to have ancient, healthy, ancient forests and the ecosystems and the species that those healthy, ancient forests support. Now, it does mean that we're going to have restraint on how much wood comes off the land. But look, we're suffering from major, major adverse impacts to the ecosystem. We're experiencing species loss. We're experiencing various and sundry other adverse impacts. For instance, and I've mentioned this many times on the show, the whole business of pesticide sprays. Now, this group of 13 conservation organizations and 13 timber companies is convening to hammer out an upgrade of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Now, this is necessitated by the fact that we are still losing species. We're still experiencing chemical trespass by pesticide sprays. And these are some of the issues that are being brought up for discussion in the legislature. There's an actual bill. The number of the bill has changed. I don't know what it is right off the top of my head, but it's before the legislature this week. And hopefully, some progress will be made to move the needle in the right direction for the health and well-being of us humans and the species that are directly exposed to the pesticide spraying, herbicide spraying that goes on after clear cutting. Now, is this agreement that these conservation organizations and timber industry folks are discussing, is it the paragon of appropriate forest management? No, it is not. Just like the Northwest Forest Plan is not. Am I suggesting that we should not go forward? No, I am not suggesting that at all. Am I suggesting that the Northwest Forest Plan ought to be dumped? No, I'm not suggesting that at all. Am I saying that either one of these processes or these laws that have been put in, regulations that have been put into place are adequate? No, they're not. But it is motion in the right direction. Now, this memorandum of understanding between these normally polarized constituents is a step in the right direction. You have to have communication. And I'll say straight up that I am one of the signatories on this memorandum of understanding on behalf of Unc Watersheds. It was a whiz-bang proposal by the governor. Various conservation organizations got on board. Many did not. And here we are. We're in the process right now of bringing it before the legislature. It's going to happen this week, if it hasn't happened already. And we'll see what happens. Now, we know that cap and trade legislation was before the short session this week, and the Republicans got up and walked out. They just walked out of the session. And so it's crippling. It's not appropriate, but it was done. I heard rumors that the governor was going to slap some fines on those individuals that up and walked out and crippled the process in the course of doing that. How can we move the needle forward, folks? I know individuals that are so upset about exposure to these chemicals. Their children are urinating these toxic compounds because of exposure, and supposedly the utilization of these pesticides has all been on the up and up and according to regulation. I'm sorry. Look, we're not living, we don't live in a perfect world. And unfortunately, economics, the greenback, has a dominating influence when it comes to these issues. But the tests don't lie. Entire communities in here in the Pacific Northwest are experiencing toxic exposure. So there's an effort being made to convene these contrasting worldviews at a table to discuss the possibilities of doing things safer and more appropriately. I have to tell you, if it was up to me, I would stop all pesticide spraying. I would increase the longevity of trees on the landscape to a minimum of 120 years. That you can't cut a tree until it's 120 years old, and when you do, you can't clear cut. And with regard to the propagation of invasive species, that's just slop. That's just human beings with their equipment plowing through one area to hustle the cutout and going to another area with all those seeds embedded in the dirt and dust of the machines. That's how they are spread. There is also a spread that is the result of birds eating seeds and propagating them, etc. But by and large, it's dirty equipment. It's the hustle. We don't need it. That being said, we're looking to limit the amount of exposure by the timber industry and their pesticide spray regimes to human beings and to water sources. So we're hoping to at least make an attempt not to pass to not pass on to future generations the legacy of our chemical trespass. Now, I know those ideas sound radical, but hey, look, we already know. Look at Monsanto and Dow are paying through the nose because they knew that there were adverse impacts of these pesticides, these herbicides, these insecticides that they were utilizing and selling and pushing off on the public. And invariably, that stuff drifts into the water system. So there's going to be an attempt to allow people to declare where their water supply is and to increase the distance that helicopter sprayers will have to be from these water sources, from people's houses, from schools. You can spray right up next to a school right now. I've seen it done. You could spray right up next to a person's residence right now. I've seen clear cuts right 50 feet from a person's house, and of course they have to spray it. Now, does that mean because I'm willing to negotiate to move the needle a little further in the right direction that I approve of anything that's going to be resolved out of this? Absolutely not. Because my keen interest is the restoration of the natural world. Pesticides and herbicides did not exist since living things came on the planet. I mean, you know, synthetic ones, Roundup, Crossbow, Atrazine, and a whole plethora of other ones. It's not natural, folks. Nevertheless, I'm here to add, the weight of Umpqua Watersheds to the dialogue, to talk to folks and to see if we can't make some attempt to go the right way. So that's a big deal this week. The water, the fish, the pesticide sprays, the buffers that should exist between various and sundry water sources and fish-bearing streams and residents and schools, etc. Keep your chemicals to yourself. Find another way to do it. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to discuss a few other things. See you in a bit. Okay, we are back. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. Let's get on another topic here. The last one was important to me. I've seen the adverse impacts of pesticides, and if I'm ever going to add my voice to the mix, I don't want it in my water. I don't want it in your water. I don't want it in your air or my air that I breathe. So, moving on, I got some fantastic news. And that has to do, any of the folks that listen regularly to the show know that I have a long been an advocate for the protection of spring Chinook populations in the state of Oregon. Now, we know the orcas need Chinook salmon, the seals, the lions, and the eagles, the osprey, the otters, birds of a broad spectrum, even little tiny birds that live on juvenile fish. All of this is in the mix. So here, about 3 months ago, the Native Fish Society, the Center for Biological Diversity, and Umpqua Watersheds petitioned for the listing of the Oregon Coastal Spring Chinook. I already mentioned to you that a major shift took place when the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife demanded that all wild spring Chinook be released on the main stem of the Umpqua. You can't keep them. Now, you can go up to the North Umpqua and fish for spring Chinook. I don't think that's a good idea, simply because those numbers are declining too. But based on recent returns of spring Chinook, which the numbers have been extremely low 2 years in a row. Actually, they've been low for 50 plus years. We've been averaging 170 fish. But when it tanked down to 28 fish and 56 fish in two consecutive years, the panic button finally was energized, and ODF&W said, whoa, we're going to lose these fish. Biologists and scientists and academics and anglers and fish lovers all up and down the coast have been saying this for years and years. But it's finally actually come down to the undeniable loss of this species. So the process generally involves writing up a petition, and the petition has to be very, very sound. It has to be science-based. It has to be data-based. You can't just look around in your backyard and say, oh, I haven't seen any toads lately over the last 25, 30 years. Maybe I ought to petition for these toads to get listed. That's not how it works. The way it does work is you gather as much valid data that you can on a specific species, and you show a very clear decline in the population, and you postulate the prospect of that decline continuing to zero. And the more sophisticated and the more clearly articulated your data is, that determines whether or not your petition is going to be accepted. Now, I know for a fact that there were other petitions before the National Marine Fisheries Service, before the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, of other species, and those petitions were not accepted. Basically, you put your petition together, you vet it, you let the Fish and Wildlife Service, state and federal, know that you are going to petition or submit a petition. You discuss this with tribal governments. You discuss it with state and federal politicians. Then you submit your petition. Once that's done, it goes through a 90-day vetting period. Meaning, it is reviewed by various and sundry agencies, scientists, and etc., and they evaluate whether or not your petition is valid. It's a specific period of time. It's 90 days, and then after 90 days, there's a declaration made, meaning, yeah, we think you might have something here. We're going to accept your petition. Now, just because they accept your petition doesn't mean that the species that you are concerned with is going to be listed under the Endangered Species Act. But what does happen is that the next step is that you go for a year-long evaluation of the situation that your particular species that you're seeking to address, how this can be resolved, should it be listed as threatened or endangered, what are the actual prospects of recovery. All these things are vetted for a period of a year. It's quite the process. It really is quite the process. Well, I know for a fact that a bunch of petitions, well, I don't want to say a bunch. Some of the petitions that were submitted at the same time ours was, were not accepted. Our petition was accepted. And rightly so. And I say kudos to those bureaucrats, academics, and scientists who finally opened their eyes a little bit and said, yeah, well, maybe they got something here. So now we'll go through a year-long process of looking at this species and determining if how dire the situation is, number one, and number two, whether or not they should be listed under the Endangered Species Act, and that if they are, what are the prospects of fixing the problem? Okay? So I'm very excited that all the hard work that these three organizations have done to make a solid petition for the Oregon Coastal Spring Chinook has been accepted. I am thrilled. It is definitely warranted. Now, whether or not they'll be listed, I don't know. What I do know is that the numbers are in decline. Coho salmon, the same thing. Coho have been listed for a long time, since the 90s. And they're still not recovered, folks. And there are a lot of reasons for it. And a big part of it is the Oregon Forest Practices Act. Another big part of it is degraded habitat that needs to be fixed. And you well know that, I mean, my whole segue into understanding the need for habitat restoration started with salmon appearing on our ranch. They hadn't been in the stream that transects our back 40 in 60 years. according to these fish biologists that have been monitoring this species. And once I saw that, and then I saw the opportunity to, I mean, there are solutions to this problem. The biggest drawback is money. There's just not enough money to go around to fix the problem. By and large, the vast majority of the money is derived from Oregon, at least in the state of Oregon, is derived from Oregon lottery dollars. Yeah. We entice people to gamble, and as a result, the state draws in a bunch of money, and the citizens of the state of Oregon said, wait, you got to use part of that income to restore habitat. Well, that's good, and I am grateful to the citizens of the state for making that a law. At the same time, I also know that there are institutions and individuals and corporations and companies that have made millions and billions of dollars degrading habitat, and they're not paying their fair share, period. They're just not. Now look, again, I'm not going to sit here and say I don't want a 2x4. I'm not going to sit here and say, no, you can't do that. But I will say, hey, how about coughing up your fair share? You don't need to be a billionaire. You don't need to be a millionaire just to supply the world with 2x4s. Do I object to your wealth? No, not really. What I object to is that you're not paying your fair share to fix the problem that you created. And if you didn't create it, at least you're still propagating, you're still creating the circumstances of degrading habitat. You're not looking at the issues that are critical here. And when you actually get real with the problem that you're causing and get serious about resolving the problem and being able to maintain your company, your corporation, or whatever it is that you have, I'll be right there with you. I'll be with you. I will help you. I will do what I can to restore this ecosystem and still keep you making a good living. Is it going to be what you're accustomed to? Nope. That's the same dynamic that's playing all out in a county level down here. Douglas County was filthy rich when they were pillaging the landscape of the public trust. And all of a sudden, they had to go cold turkey. They didn't like it. So now what do they want to do? They want to get the cutout again. They remember the good old days. So in a big sense, the counties are culpable also. They got their fair share out of it. And now that instead of spending the money that the federal government has been giving them to have them adapt to a different economy, they're using those same dollars to lobby to get the cutout again. We need to diversify our culture. We need to do something else besides pillage the landscape. I've got dear friends who were participants who refused to participate in Governor Kate Brown's MOU for valid reasons from my perspective. One of them is landslides, logging on such steep ground that You're destroying the habitat even further. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski. Let's take another break. We'll be back in a minute.
Roseburg's Independent Radio 99.7 KQUA.
99.7 KQUA is a public service of Umpqua Watersheds. Umpqua Watersheds is a nonprofit environmental conservation organization dedicated to the protection and restoration of the Umpqua Watersheds. Their mission is to serve the community through education, training, advocacy, and ecologically sound stewardship. Online at umpquawatersheds.org and Facebook.
We're back. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski. We're talking about the multiplicity of issues that have come to the fore in this very week. The next thing I want to discuss is there was a great workshop this past weekend. It involved OSU Extension Service, Oregon State University Extension Service. It involved the Department of Forestry of the state of Oregon. It involved the National Resource Conservation Service as an agency. And there was a presentation by a group of academics addressing the issue of climate change and its impact on the forests here in southwestern Oregon. Now, fortunately, there have been academics that have been gathering information for many, many years. In fact, the one specific individual that I'm thinking of is Dr. Julia Jones, hydrologist from the H.G. Andrews Experimental Forest. She's been gathering data on summer low flows and on climate, and on the impact of clear-cut logging on our water supply. Fantastic scientist, very credible, done a lot of valid work. And she, this is some years ago, I want to say it was 15 years ago. She came to our area of southwestern Oregon and gave a presentation at the Coyote Creek Experimental Forest paired watershed study, and she brought up the issue of climate change. And basically, the short and the sweet of it is that she said that she clearly sees the signature of climate change in the hydrological processes of southern Oregon. At the time, it wasn't so significant up north near Corvallis and up by the H.J. Andrews Experimental Forest. But definitely here in southern Oregon, she said that she saw a clear signature, a clear signal that climate was changing and impacting the hydrological regimes of this area. Fast forward 15 years. We're looking at hundreds of thousands of young, medium, and old conifers dying. We're looking at an increase in fire in scale and scope. Now, I know for a fact that the particular area in which I live, the fire interval was between 15 and 25 years. You can tell this by the old growth forest. They would cut a big old tree down and you could see the fire scars. And like I said, depending on the aspect, whether it's north-facing slope, south-facing slope, et cetera, the fire interval was between 15 and 25 years. Now, since 2000, I have seen a fire every single year, a large hot fire every single year that I have lived in this area. Some of them very, very close to my home. Now, if the fire interval is between 15 and 25 years, why am I seeing them every year or every other year since the year 2000? 2002, it was a huge fire. Some of these are man-made. Some of these are lightning-made fires. Suffice it to say, now, and back in the early 2000s, I didn't see a lot of trees dying like I am now. They may have been, but it wasn't that noticeable to me. What I'm looking at now is phenomenal. I lived in way up in the northwest corner of Montana, in a forest that we called the Big Red Forest because it was lodgepole pine and the pine bark beetle was decimating the entire landscape. That being said, I want to clearly say that lodgepole as a species cannot propagate unless it has fire. It is a species that is adapted to fire. The cones won't open up until there's been a fire. That being said, if the fire's too hot, it burns all the cones up. The tree, that species of tree manifests itself in such a fashion that when you read what the tree has to say, I'm dropping my cones and I need a fire interval here. And it cannot sterilize the soil, and it cannot consume the cone. So that is a fire-adapted species. It's part of the regime. What's going on, though, here now? And we're talking Doug fir and incense cedar, specifically in our area. Big trees. Not little trees. Little trees are dying too, for sure. But big trees. So we had this workshop. It was a great workshop. Climate scientists presented. Entomologists presented. Firewise. Specialists were on topic and preparing. You know, nobody wants to have another Paradise, California, especially when you live in the middle of the forest. And so it was a great workshop, and we took a tour of the ranch here, and we looked at dead trees, and we said, well, what's going on? It was interesting. There was a cedar. I'd say it was 30 inches in diameter. It died. And we asked this entomologist, we said, well, hey, what killed this tree? And he looked at it and looked at it and looked at it. He said, I don't know. And then he tried to extract a segment of bark off of the tree to determine whether or not it was, you know, borers or some kind of beetle larva that was girdling the cambium layer or anything like that. So he spent quite a bit of time trying to cut out a segment of bark on this large tree to analyze what was going on underneath. So he takes off this segment of bark, and it had no beetle boring larval marks on it at all. This tree just went belly up. It wasn't an ancient, I've seen huge old cedars. It wasn't that big. I mean, there was a cedar taken off of this property that was 6 foot in diameter when they cut it down to harvest it. No, this tree just died because of drought stress. And it was not a young tree. I would have to say it had to be near 50 years old plus. Well, that's young for a tree. Maybe it was 75 years old, but all of a sudden it blinks out. Bye-bye. And we looked at other species, and we considered the species that were more vulnerable than others. We talked about the various and sundry treatments that can take place on the landscape and, you know, what can be done to make the property more fire resilient. And, of course, what I'm really interested in is negotiating with the Department of Forestry and also the U.S. Forest Service and allowing fire to be returned to the property here. Now, there's some issues with that. There most certainly are. One of them is Medusa head or cheatgrass, invasive grasses that love fire. They can endure a fire, and they you know, it makes them healthy, wealthy, and wise. So we'll have to figure out some method of managing those types of species, but by and large, we just need to allow this fire regime to return to the landscape. The biomass is just going to increase. It's going to grow. It grows every year. And we suppress fire every year. And it's now gotten to the point where the fire regime is out of kilter. And like I said, since the 2000s, I've been watching one fire after another. I live in smoke just about every summer. Poison oak smoke. So the intent of the workshop was to contact landowners and say, hey, look, here's some things that you can do. First of all, to protect your home, protect your property, but also to be a good steward of your land and to allow appropriate intervention into the land because fire has been suppressed for so long. And of course, we're doing that. We're very actively engaged in doing that here on the ranch right now. All right. So that was the workshop. It was fantastic. They're going to have another one in Roseburg coming up very soon. Please contact the Oregon State University Extension Service to get filled in on that. Also, I think they're going to have a similar workshop in Curry County. So contact those folks. Get informed. It was amazing. We had people from all the way from Reedsport coming up here. I mean, that's like a two-hour ride. And folks from great distances up near Portland came all the way down for this workshop, and it was really cool to interact with folks and to address some of the serious problems that we're facing as a result of the legacy of forest mismanagement that we are heirs of and propagators of. So if you want to be a good steward and you want to learn how to help the wildlife and plant life and human life within your sphere of influence and impact, please contact those folks. If you want to contact me, be sure to do that. Stanley@UmpquaWatersheds.org. You can Google it. You can Google Umpqua Watersheds. I'm on the board there. You can find contact information that way. See you in a little bit. Right, we are back. This is the last segment, and I got hornswoggled into a rabbit hole this week, and it had to do with tortoises. Now, if you don't know it, tortoises are land animals, and turtles are water animals. That's a pretty cut and dry definition, but that's generally how the academics separate these particular animals. And I was very, very excited to hear that in the Galapagos, where there is had been a wildlife paradise, there's a tortoise that was declared extinct in 1909. Now, if you don't know it, and I've mentioned this before in the show, if you don't know it, the tortoises of the Galapagos were there in the thousands and thousands. The various islands had unique tortoise species associated with them, and there was a thriving population of them until after Columbus decided that the world was round and ships began to traverse the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, that they found the Galapagos Islands, and in the process, hungry sailors would come up and catch turtles and eat their meat. They also extracted various and sundry oils out of these tortoises. And in the process, all of the populations diminished, and several species of tortoises from those islands went extinct. Well, in 2019, they discovered a single female tortoise that had been declared extinct. And they found this tortoise in one of the volcanic islands down in this caldera. And they're hoping that they will find some males and allow for this species to be recovered. Now, one of the other aspects of human intervention that caused this species to become so rare was the fact that goats, rats, and swine were turned loose on these islands. And as a result, the tortoise population was decimated. Swine will eat anything. Rats will eat eggs. And these islands just were overrun with these invasive species, and goats were, you know, devouring the vegetation. They were an invasive. And the native species were going extinct. It's exactly what we're experiencing right here in Oregon, in Douglas County. And I was excited to hear that a reasonably well-funded individual associated with the Animal Planet channel. I don't own a TV, but I gathered from the YouTube videos that I was watching that there is this channel, and they were funded this journey to the Galapagos, and they actually found this species of turtle that they believed was extinct. Now, it takes two to tango, and there is hope that return trips will be made, and that more of these tortoises and this particular species of tortoise will be found and recovered. That's exciting. Yeah, it's, you know, thousands of miles away and it doesn't have a direct impact on you, but the fact that there are people that care is very cool. The fact that habitat restoration work is taking place in these remote areas. They're getting rid of the rats, the goats, and the pigs. In this same arena, there is a group of tortoises that are now released to their native island in the Galapagos. And one particular male has been able to propagate the species with a half a dozen or more females, and 800 of these baby tortoises were released back into their natural environment on one of the islands of the Galapagos. That is soothing to my soul. It encourages me to speak with you and to talk with you about preventing our own unique species from disappearing. And it really does matter that you care. Yes, there are agency people that are responsible for the recovery of endangered and threatened species, but you know what? They need your support. Think of the Upquachub. Here in Douglas County, this little tiny minnow is not found anywhere else in the world. If it dies, if it goes the way of the trend is for diminishing populations of this little fish that once was abundant in our watershed. Here now, they're being devoured by bass, they're being devoured by degrading habitat, peak flows, summer low flows, all of those, death by a thousand cuts. So you don't have to travel thousands and thousands of miles to, you know, help keep the biological diversity that our world produced. And it produced it for good reason. It wasn't whimsical. It wasn't arbitrary. I don't believe that the natural world functions in that way. But species adapt and they become unique to a geographical area, and you are living in an area where these species are disappearing and going extinct. Like, for instance, the summer steelhead run on the South Fork of the Umpqua River. Or the spring Chinook run of the entire Umpqua Basin. you live in an area that at one time was as biologically diverse as the Galapagos. Year by year by year, that diversity, that complexity, the beauty and mystery of this ecosystem has been progressively distorted. We don't need to let that happen. We can recover it. And there are beautiful, generous, intelligent people that are interested in doing that. Think of the beaver. How important are they in the system? We need them. We're not going to recover the salmon or the very rare frogs and salamanders and birds and insects and plants that are associated with beaver ecology that was here for millennia. We just come in and say, nope, we don't want them here and kill them. Do we really think that way? I mean, do we really? I think part of the problem is that a lot of us don't understand how important that complexity is to maintain the health and well-being of ourselves as individuals. You know, the whole concept of positive self-interest. So yes, the Umpqua Chub, the fact that they could bring a tortoise population back from a remote island somewhere is encouraging to me. The fact that it can even be done is phenomenal. That being said, you and I, we live in an area filled with exotic treasures. You have no idea of the majestic diversity of plant life that exists in the Umpqua Basin. We see trees, we see oaks, we see conifers, we see pines, we see this, madrones, we see this and that. But the reality is there are flowers, wildflowers and orchids that are disappearing because of our disregard of and lack of sensitivity of the environment we live in. That being said, there are people that care. They need your support. Whether it's pond turtles, the Umpqua Chub, beaver, whether it's predatory birds, raptors, the Umpqua pike minnow. Yeah, all these need your help. And there are agencies that are here to help. But they need to hear your voice. They need you to contact them. Talk to a man this week who is an expert in bird species, identifying birds, and he's famous for being able to replicate bird sounds. He's really good at it. And I encouraged him. I said, hey, the public needs to hear your voice. They need you to tell, you need to teach us about these birds. And I've got a neighbor who is a photographer and a bird watcher. And she has captured some 60 plus rare species of birds right here in our little tiny sub watershed, a little tributary of the Umpqua, South Umpqua River. Just because she took the time to watch and to be informed. And you don't have to be an expert bird watcher or a herpetologist to deal with the loss of the spotted frog or the yellow-legged frog. But if you have an inclination for plant life, animal life, wildlife, get a hold of these agency people and say, hey, I want to be informed. I want to know why monarch butterflies, I haven't seen them anymore. They'll help you and you can help them and they'll tell you how. And if you're kind of shy about doing that, contact me. Don't hesitate. Send me an email, stanley@umpquawatersheds.org. I'll work with you. This is the Radioactive Restoration Show. I'm your host, Stan Petrowski. Well, the whole hour has gone by so quickly. I hope you enjoyed the show. We're going gangbusters. We're not going to let the proverbial web of life go down the proverbial tube. Catch you next week.